Hey, what's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. Randeep Janda still filling in for Thomas Drantz today. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. If you can bring the music there down, Dom, thank you. I appreciate that. So obviously before we get into the meat of the show, I want to address what happened in Vancouver over the weekend. As I'm sure we've all heard by now, of course, the horrible tragedy at the Lapu Lapu Day Festival on Fraser Street on Saturday left 11 people dead, more in hospital. And don't want to spend too much time here because I know some people looking for a distraction, looking for something else to think about. But obviously we want to say that we're keeping the loved ones of the victims in our hearts, the Filipino community, of course, the Sunset community in East Vancouver, where it happened. Unimaginable what those people are going through. Just a horrible, horrible thing. Some people calling it, you know, one of the worst days in the city of Vancouver's history. And I think, Randeep, about street festivals, how important they are, what a incredible part of spring and summer in the city of Vancouver they are, and to have that one end like that is simply awful. There's no words that can really do it justice, but as I said, we're keeping the loved ones of all the victims and the Filipino community especially in our hearts right now.
Absolutely. We're there with the community. We are part of the community, and this is a tight-knit community. So, you know, in moments like this, a terrible situation, it's important for us to show up and be the friends that we can be in the community. And this was supposed to be a day where people came together, they celebrated, maybe they reconnected. It's supposed to be a day where you kind of, you know, have those laughs, and it's a positive experience. And unfortunately, it turned into a nightmare. This is a terrible situation, and our hearts go out to the community. There are positive things that you can do during this time, though, and you know, it's great to see that people are donating blood because there is a need.
Yes.
Those slots are filling up for Canadian Blood Services. But if you are in a position to do so, please go out there and donate, because as you mentioned, there are still people in hospital. There are still people that are in very serious conditions that do require that need. So once again, our hearts go to the victims, their families, and of course, the community.
Absolutely. And I also just want to say it's a great point about donating blood as well. If you're looking for the latest and up to the minute information, you can tune in to our friends at City News 1130, of course, just across the hall. You can visit their website, vancouver.citynews.ca, as well. And I just want to give a word of respect for the incredible professionalism and the dedication for that whole team over there, especially that they showed over the weekend, covering again one of the worst days in our city's history. Once again, our thoughts and our hearts are with everyone impacted by what happened on Saturday. All right, there's never an easy way to turn out of that, but as I said, we are going to do our best to give something people something else to think about, maybe a little bit of a distraction here in this city today. So coming up on the show, Kevin Woodley is going to join us at 12:30, of course, from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine, and it's at 1, excuse me. Well, there you go. Thank you, Lena. Kevin Woodley's going to join us at 1 o'clock on the show. And it's a great day to have Woodley on because goaltending, a major part of the discussion, especially in Winnipeg, but in other markets as well, with the Stanley Cup playoffs right now. So we'll get into all of that with Woodley at 1. Now, if this is correct, right? Manny Malhotra at 1:30? Nailed it? All right, great. Manny Malhotra, Abbotsford Canucks head coach, fresh off a series win, will join us at 1:30.
50% is a passing grade, Jamie. You're good.
That's how I got through college, baby. 50%.
Yeah, you went to law school, man. You got more than 50%.
Well, I barely passed some of those classes. Maybe that's why I'm here now instead of a successful lawyer. Here, yeah, that's why we're both here. So Kevin Woodley at 1, Manny Malhotra at 1:30. Send your text in as well. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. But right now, let's go to the whiteboard.
All right, now, fellas. Hey, let's focus up, huh?
It is your daily deep dive into what's up with the Canucks and the NHL for today, April 28th. And we'll start with the headlines. Now, there's a lot we got to get into with the coaching carousel situation in the NHL. We'll do that in just a second in the broadsheet, but we can run through some headlines from the weekend. And look, a fantastic weekend of playoff hockey. And really what I want to focus on, with all due respect to the Eastern Conference, all four series in the West tied up. 2-2 now. And it looked early in the first round like we might see some blowouts, right? Like, okay, is Winnipeg, are they going to sweep St. Louis? Edmonton jumps out to a 2-0 lead on LA. Vegas, is that going to be a competitive series? We had some questions there. Now we're sitting here all tied 2-2. And my question is, and feel free to text in, I'll put it to you at Randeep as well. Which series in the West are you most interested in from this point forward? Because I think the landscape for me on that question looks completely different than it would have at the start of the round. Because I'm thinking about not just the hockey I'm enjoying the most, which games might have the most drama, but the potential fallout from all of these series. And from that perspective, the one that rockets to the top of my list now is LA and Edmonton. LA, two chances in Edmonton with third period leads to either sweep the series if they close out both, or at the very least be going home up 3-1 for game five. They let Edmonton off the hook both times. Now the series is tied thanks to a couple of overtime wins for Edmonton. You had the controversial challenge that was ultimately unsuccessful and maybe cost his team the game from Jim Hiller on Friday. A brutal, brutal failed clear from Quinton Byfield last night. And now all of a sudden you're sitting here and thinking, man, if they blow this and lose to Edmonton for the fourth straight year, what happens there? And we've already talked about the potential fallout and the potential big challenges in Edmonton. Now both of those teams feel like if they lose this series, it could be a judgment day type situation for their organization.
Yeah, what makes this different this year is with LA, they look like they could get this done early on in the series. The first two games, you smack around Edmonton a little bit, you have the existential crisis in Edmonton. They're trying to figure
out. By the way, I think I said Edmonton went up 2-0 on LA, according to the inbox. I meant LA went up 2-0 on Edmonton. Come on, guys.
Like I said, 50% passing grade. It's all good. All right? Go. We acknowledge there's going to be a little bit of a. It happens. It's live radio.
Yeah.
The other thing is, though, yeah, with Edmonton, they were having the existential crisis after two games. They were the ones looking inward to say, how do we maybe even shelter Evan Bouchard a little bit? How do you, figure out what's going on with goaltending? The $9.25 million man is playing like a gentle giant, Darnell Nurse. That's changed because, and it's going to go back to that Hiller challenge to me. I think that's when you start doubting yourself as a team, where you're saying, did we make the right move? Did we lose because of that? And you're right. You know, Byfield, brutal mistake. You chip it out to the neutral zone. You release some pressure. Even if it goes off the boards, you waste probably 10 to 15 to 20 seconds there, right? You really limit that attack from Edmonton. You don't get it out there. And now the issue with LA is that you're losing the big moments. And Edmonton is a team that thrives off the big moments. They can get outworked and outplayed for 2 out of 3 periods. But if they put together a good period with that superpower that they have, Draisaitl, McDavid, that's all they need.
Even 6-on-5, right? It's... You have McDavid and Draisaitl out there. Like, it almost feels inevitable. If you let them get to a 1-goal, 6-on-5 situation, like, you are playing with fire, and LA got burned last night, and especially Quinton Byfield got burned. You can't let it get to that situation.
No, and it's almost an impossible situation in the sense that if you make one mistake, it's going to cost you against those guys. But that's how good they are, and that's how airtight you have to be. Unless you are an elite team, and I look at the Floridas and the Tampas and maybe some other teams that have firepower that can match the McDavid and Draisaitls. Like, not everybody can, but there are still superstar players, like a Nate McKinnon, who can go head-to-head with a Connor McDavid. LA doesn't have that guy.
No.
So you have to make sure that you're airtight defensively in your decision-making, and that's two areas that they've messed up royally the last two games.
Yeah, and, if you lose 4 times in a row to the same team in the playoffs, and at least a couple of those series, you're up. You're up in the series, right? And this one, you're up 2-0. You're third period leads in games 3 and 4. If you blow it from here, there's going to have to be some serious, serious soul searching and potentially big changes in LA. We can talk about that a little bit later when we do our latest pitch a player for the Canucks top 6 issues later on in the show. What series in the West is keeping your interest the most, Randy?
Oh, it comes down to St. Louis Winnipeg
sure,
for me.
Sure.
This is the Connor Hellebuck storyline of 11 goals against in the last two games. He's got a sub-800 save percentage in both of those games. It is, I think, a crisis in confidence right now for the league's best goaltender. He's on his way to win another Vezina, but the mentality of him doubting himself, you can see it in his play where he's kind of stuck in no man's land, right? And I'm very curious to hear Kevin Woodley's thoughts a little bit later on in the show, because Kevin can break it down and what he's seeing. But Hellebuck does play a little deeper in his net, usually, even when he's successful. But what we're seeing right now is he's just being a little tentative. And when he's on his best, he's not tentative. He kind of, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but he's giving me late Luongo in Vancouver vibes, where remember we could see Luongo doubt himself. There's that confidence to say when he was elite, he was elite. But when there were some cracks, we could all see it. It was evident to everybody that this is not a confident goaltender. Connor Hellebuck is showing that right now.
Yeah, it's a massive, man, there's so many different angles to go with this with the Jets as well, because there's problems in front of him. You don't want to take all the blame from Hellebuck. He's going to win the Vezina Trophy again this year. Yep. The nominees were announced today. You need saves as well, but it's just such a fascinating dynamic there that I want to get into more with Kevin Woodley at 1 o'clock when he joins the show. Really excited to get his thoughts on it. We'll talk more about some of the playoff series and the matchups tonight as well as the show goes on. Other thing I want to mention quickly in headlines, Abbotsford beats Tucson 5-0 on Saturday in a decisive Game 3 to advance to the second round of the Calder Cup playoffs. Archer Shelovs with a 21-save shutout. The Canucks take on Seattle's affiliate, the Coachella Valley Firebirds, in a best-of-five second-round series. We're all learning so much about the Calder Cup playoffs format. First two games are in California starting on Thursday. Final three will be in Abbotsford. I believe that was Abbotsford's choice. They could choose if they wanted to start the series in Coachella and have the three at the end in Abbotsford, or vice versa. They chose this. There you go.
Okay. I didn't know that.
We're all learning a lot.
So they're kind of taking the European model of where you can pick your opponent. Maybe not to the extreme. You can pick
a little bit.
You can pick a little bit, but we don't want to. Hockey culture is still hockey culture, where you don't want to tick off the opponent to say, I can't believe they picked us.
But they're setting up for the final three games, if it goes that far, of the best of five. Will be in Abbotsford. It starts Thursday in Coachella. We'll talk more about that matchup with Manny Malhotra at 1:30. All right, let's get to the broadsheet and the rumor roundup around the league. And this is all focusing on the coaching situation here in Vancouver and other coaching situations around the league as well. So first and foremost, Rick Tocchet watch continues. No update, no news, no decision. Jim Rutherford said last week he expected a decision by the end of last week. We're past that deadline, no matter how you count it. And so it's extending. And Elliot Friedman said on 32 Thoughts that Rick Tocchet and the Canucks had some meetings on Friday. No decision as of Sunday night. He was on with Donnie and Dolly this morning and updated and said, hearing no decision this morning either. So things are starting to drag on a little bit here. And that's significant to me because big coaching news in the NHL today, Mike Sullivan, the second longest tenured coach in the NHL, two-time Stanley Cup winner with the Pittsburgh Penguins, he's out. And immediately I saw a lot of people jump to, well, hey, we know who his general manager was for a lot of that in Pittsburgh. It was Jim Rutherford. Patrick Alvin was there as well. There's a connection. Could Mike Sullivan be an option for the Vancouver Canucks should they need a new head coach? To me, that's not the Vancouver tie-in to the Mike Sullivan story, because what are we hearing on Rick Tocchet? They've made an offer that's good money, better than they typically pay head coaches, but in Elliot Friedman's words, maybe Tocchet doesn't even see it as his market value. Mm-hmm. If you're not meeting Rick Tocchet's market value, are you going to be willing to meet Mike Sullivan's market value? That's a major question I would have. What it does mean to me is that, does it change what Rick Tocchet's options look like should he leave Vancouver now with a bigger name by any definition on the market in Mike Sullivan?
Okay, let's look at some of these teams, though, because I think with Philadelphia, that market doesn't change. If Philadelphia likes Rick Tocchet, it's probably still, he's probably name number one still on their list. The Rangers is the job that I look at to say, all right, did you end up getting a cup-winning coach, a coach that knows that market because he was on John Tortorella's staff as well going way back when? Does this change that? If that was the kind of the X factor here of the Rangers, if they want this coach, they're going to go, you know, they've got deep pockets. They've got a team that's maybe closer to the cup than any other market out there right now. That is the one that I look at and say, okay, Rick Tocchet maybe is number two on that list now, because with Mike Sullivan, it's been a tough couple of years in Pittsburgh, but he's a cup winning coach. He won that twice. And that's almost a ready-made team that needs some discipline, that needs some defensive structure in New York. So I think from a leverage perspective, Rick Tocchet, no doubt, takes a hit here when it comes to that job. Now, the question is, was he seriously considering that job?
Did he need that leverage?
Exactly.
That's an interesting part of the question here.
Well,
yeah.
Philly could be all the leverage you need.
Yeah.
Because it could be Vancouver versus Philly. If we're talking about head-to-head, maybe New York was a factor, maybe they weren't. But I think with the leverage element of saying, hey, we talked about it last week, there's six teams that have coaching vacancies. Now there's seven. I certainly think the leverage when it comes to the biggest heavyweight in that conversation, maybe looking elsewhere, it takes a little bit of a hit.
Yeah, you know, we should also mention Elliot Friedman on Donnie and Dolly pointing out a couple of things relevant of his conversation. One, which is that when Chris Drury took over as general manager of the Rangers, desperately tried to get Mike Sullivan out of Pittsburgh, wasn't able to, obviously. So there's a connection there and a very strong previous interest in bringing Sullivan in to coach the New York Rangers. Friedman also said if he had to bet, if Rick Tocchet's coaching next year, it's either Vancouver or Philly. So as you said, maybe it doesn't matter what the coaching landscape looks like outside of that. But you're always still better off with more options. The more options you have, the better, right? Because if things do break down with Vancouver and you're all in on Philly, well, now you're just negotiating with one team. You know, from Rick Tocchet's perspective, if it goes that direction, you'd love to have more teams interested. Maybe he still does,
yeah.
Right? With, hey, Pittsburgh, that's an open job. Kyle Dubas worked with him through the Four Nations.
Also knows Sid and Gino.
Was interested in hiring him to be Canada's coach of the World Championships. As you says, has the relationship with Sidney Crosby and Gino Malkin. That could add some leverage to Rick Tocchet's hand as well. It probably is Philly or Vancouver, as Elliot Friedman said, but you'd still always love to have more options out there.
I think the sequencing and timing matters here because let's say Mike Sullivan's going to New York and he signs a lucrative deal. If you're Rick Tocchet, that could work in your favor as well because you have a set number for the number one coach on the market. And then you can say, hey, if Mike Sullivan's making that much, I know where I fit in. I can push that much further.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to be the one that signs first or do you want to wait? So waiting might be actually in the interest of Rick Tocchet. I know the Canucks organization probably is not a fan of that. They put the shot clock up last week and Rick Tocchet essentially said, this is playground rules. There is no shot clock.
And Kevin Weeks from ESPN putting it out there. Per my conversation with several team owners, executives and coaches, given the timing, $7 billion plus of NHL revenues and other factors, Sullivan can reset the coach's compensation market. Does he get to or eclipse the high watermark $7 million per season? So that's Kevin Weeks, based on his conversations, putting out their potential market price for Mike Sullivan. To your point, now all of a sudden, if Sullivan signs for $7 million, $5 million looks like a tier two number all of a sudden, right? Because the top end cup winning coach market is set at $7 million. Does that help Rick Tocchet? And I do think, just in general, we mentioned this on the show yesterday. Okay, it's one thing for it to go through the weekend, but like by Wednesday of this week, you figure everyone's probably getting antsy. And now you're seeing major dominoes fall. You're getting to the point where, hey, we need some answers here, right? We have to see what else is out there. You want to be able to talk to other teams. There's no sense in dragging this on much more to me, even another 24, 48 hours here. Elliot Friedman said it sounds like a decision maybe is coming soon, but he also said, you know, the Canucks hope it's going to be this week. It has to be by the end of this week. Like that would be stunning to me if there is no resolution by the end of this week to this coaching situation, given the stakes involved on every side. The other note I wanted to make from Elliot Friedman's reporting on this, which is that, yeah, they're talking about a contract and they're trying to, you know, get term and money and all that figured out. And Quinn Hughes's future, that's a big deal. The direction of the team, that's a big deal for Rick Tocchet. The other thing that's been a bit of a sticking point, the lack of a practice facility here in Vancouver. That apparently has been a hangup for Tocchet. Friedman also suggesting maybe that's why Rutherford spoke at such length about a practice facility when he addressed the media last week. And this is really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, it's like, well, Rick, even if you sign a five-year deal, you're probably not getting a practice facility in that. Like, best case scenario.
Yeah.
They get a deal done for a plot of land tomorrow. Designs, approvals, permits, construction. I mean, we're talking 3 or 4 years, I would think.
Unless...
Let's not talk about that.
Sorry, Jim, we have to. Unless you go back to the original plan where it's a ready-made facility and... That's in the community.
It's not what we heard from Rutherford, but you never know. You don't want to shut the door on that. Maybe
exactly.
That is a possibility.
That's my point, though. That's the only one. That's the only way you can probably have Rick Tocchet in the fold is if you're going back to somewhere in the community to say, hey, we're going to adapt this to our needs.
Yeah.
But to your point, Rutherford last time out, said it looks like that's probably not the case.
Yeah. And the other fact, so that is interesting to me, right? Because it's like, that's not necessarily a short-term issue we can solve for you, right? Like, that's very different than, hey, I want a little bit more money, or I need this assistant, right? Those are solvable issues from the perspective of management. Practice facility, that's a long-term big picture thing. If that's your hang up as a coach, I don't know how much there is we can do to help you there. The other thing that's really fascinating is, to me, this feels like the practice facility going from kind of a back burner issue, which is on the periphery. And, you know, we ask Rutherford about it once a year when he speaks to the media at the end of the season. We get an update or a non-update. It feels like it going from a back burner issue to a front burner thing, because with Calgary getting a deal to build one, the Canucks soon are going to be the only team in the NHL that does not have a practice facility. And we get texts in like, hey, what's the big deal? They practice at Rogers or they go to UBC. Who cares about a practice facility? And whatever you think about the importance of it, and, you know, whether it's actually adding points in the standings or helping guys get better, it matters for people in the game. And talent retention and the ability to attract talent is a big deal. In a way, this feels a little bit like a dry run of the Quinn Hughes situation, where you have a key member of your organization that you're trying to convince to take your money and stay in Vancouver, who you think can be a part of the solution. And the practice facility matters. And being the only one out of 32 not to have one, that matters, and it's going to pose issues and problems for the franchise down the road.
Well, you mentioned Calgary, but I'm going to give you two examples that I've heard from players directly kind of changed the game. One is Vegas. When they got into the league, the fact that players live near that practice rink changed the game. So you have the tax benefit in Nevada. On top of that, you've got a community that your practice rink is, what, 5 minutes away. That matters to players. Having that, hey, that's where I'm going to go. This is where my family is going to be. To fans, it doesn't matter. To broadcasters, it doesn't matter. But to those players that are signing and they are able to call their shot, that's the difference here.
Yeah.
Right? When you're drafted, you got no choice. But if you're trying to dip into no movement clauses and UFA status, this is the stuff that matters. The other one I'm going to, and we've all laughed at Florida at certain points in our lives watching hockey, right? And other reasons, Florida man, go through that. Just in general. But one thing that they've sorted out in the last couple of years, too, is they've got a state-of-the-art facility near where the players live as well. Like, these things matter. So when you're trying to find that competitive edge, being a Canadian market can only go so far. Hockey matters here can only go so far. You have to have that competitive advantage of, this is where we're going to practice, and it's X amount of minutes away from Yale Town or West Van or Shaughnessy or wherever you live. Those are the real life things that players have to deal with. So I think there is an element of this conversation that Elliot brought up, whether the coach as well. Remember, practice time and the way you practice matters so much to coaches. There's got to be an element of truth there, no doubt.
And I think what's happened is a great point about Vegas, right? And them coming in with the practice facility. Now Seattle as well. It gets rave reviews for what they've done with their facility. What's happened over the last maybe 10 years, if you want to say eight, since Vegas has come into the league, is it feels like a practice facility has gone from kind of a nice like bonus, like the cherry on top, to a baseline, right? Like that, when it's 31 out of 32, now it's a baseline expectation. And it's not just that it's like that the practice facilities in other markets are attracting people there. It's that the lack of one is like, well, hey, hold on a second. Why are you the only team that doesn't have one? Why are you the only team that doesn't check this box? And again, whatever you think about the importance of a practice facility in and of itself, when it's, when you're the odd team out, that's going to be a big deal, and that's going to be potentially a problem down the road. So we can talk more about the coaching situation around the league. We'll see if we get any further updates about Rick Tocchet in the next couple hours, today, tomorrow. I would think soon, but who knows? Who knows with this situation? Quick lineup note here. Lineup roster note here in the whiteboard today. Sawyer Mineo, Canucks defensive prospect, joins Abbotsford in Coachella after his WHL season ended with Calgary. Would be a little surprising to drop him into me into the lineup in the Calder Cup playoffs, but a great chance for him to get some practice time in that environment, and he'll be starting his pro career next year with Abbotsford. So good for Sawyer Mineo to get that chance.
Get some practice reps in, but I love the edge of this player. Even for a young player at camp, he was throwing the body around. He was getting under the skin of a lot of players, so doubt he features in games, but at the very least, he's going to be able to practice, and hopefully next training camp, he comes in there even more kind of possessed to win a spot, or at least
get his pro career started on the right foot next year in Abbotsford. All right, time quickly here for One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. Only a couple of games on the playoff schedule tonight, starting with the Tampa Bay Lightning and the Florida Panthers. Tampa looking to even that series at two games apiece. And my One to Watch is going to be a player who, very notably in the game when a lot of people thought he might miss this one, that's Matthew Tkachuk, who will not be suspended for his late hit on Jake Guentzel in the previous game. A lot of people saw the Brandon Hagel precedent for his hit on Barkov and said, well, that seems pretty straightforward. Matthew Tkachuk's going to be suspended for a game. Not the case. And you know, given it's Matthew Tkachuk, this rivalry, all of that, he's in the lineup when people don't think he should be. There's going to be a lot of attention on him, and this is the situation he thrives in, right? That he's in the heads inherently now. He's making a difference in that way. I'm watching for Matthew Tkachuk to, one, get under the skin even more of Tampa, but also to step up in this type of situation and have a big game for Florida.
Yeah, this is going to be a very Weasley matchup where you've got, you know, Matthew Tkachuk at his best, but my player to watch is going to be Brandon Hagel. He's coming back from suspension.
Sure, yeah.
He's going to have a chip on his shoulder, maybe a little bit of more of a chip because Tkachuk did not get suspended for a similar hit, you could say.
Now, is there any recent history between Brandon Hagel and Matthew Tkachuk?
It's funny that you asked. Four Nations face-off off the opening draw. Matthew Tkachuk versus Brandon Hagel. Tkachuk will probably have to answer for that hit on Guentzel. I could see Brandon Hagel being the one saying, let's go again.
All right, let's have a rematch from the Four Nations. I like it. That is One to Watch, brought to you by Delaney's OK Tire. It's time to put on your Toyo tires. Whether you drive a car, light truck, or van, Toyo tires are designed to perform in all kinds of conditions. Visit Delaney's OK Tire in Langley and Aldergrove. That's the whiteboard. Send your text in 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll read some on the other side. Plus, I will pitch another player of interest that the Canucks maybe could take a shot at acquiring in the offseason. That's next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, special guest co-host Randeep Janda in studio as well, filling in for Thomas Drance. Canucks Talk brought to you, this hour of Canucks Talk brought to you, excuse me, by Rack Steel. Rack Steel offers industry-leading heli forklifts and engineered racking solutions. Visit them online at racksteel.com. We're broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. All right. Lots of texts coming in about the coaching carousel in the NHL and obviously the Rick Tocchet situation, as well as the lack of practice facility, which we can read some of soon here. But we've been doing a thing the last few days on the show, Randy, where we take turns pitching a player, a target for the Canucks to address their massive needs in the top six going into next year. Center or wing, because really, it's both. We know center, and we know that. But they need a talent upgrade on the wing as well, especially if Brock Besser's not back.
And we're trying to go with players that, yeah, there's been so much discussion in this market about Paterka and go through the big names and all that. But we're trying to go a level deeper.
Little off the beaten path, which is why I pitched Trevor Zegras. Again, everyone loved it. You came with Barrett Hayton,
which everybody thought was a lukewarm one. But like,
we're not doing great.
I'm dealing in the real world, folks.
So mine is building on our conversation a little bit from the first segment about potential fallout depending on how these playoff series go. And somebody texted in like, what? You're saying just because you lose in the first round, you have to make changes? You don't have to. But if you have expectations about going deep as a team and you lose in the first round, that's something that teams might choose to do, especially in the case of the LA Kings. If you are banging your head against the wall named the Edmonton Oilers again for the fourth straight year and find yourself exiting in the first round after going up 2-0, after having third period leads in games 3 and 4. So I think a lot of people might go to Quentin Byfield here, a 22-year-old center, and, oh, is he going to pay the price for that turnover? Byfield, still the potential. He's under contract till 2029 at 6.25. He's only 22. I don't see a price that the Canucks would be willing or able to pay getting Quinton Byfield out from LA. I think that's a non-starter from the LA Kings perspective. The forward I'm looking at for LA might be a non-starter as well, but it's on the wing and it's Adrian Kempe. And first of all, I love Adrian Kempe's game. Like, huge fan of this player. He's extremely productive. He's got edge. He's got speed. He's reliable two-way. To me, he's not an elite player. He's not a superstar player, but he is that next tier down where he is just a bona fide, awesome, top line, really effective NHL player. So you lay all that out and it's like, well, why the heck is LA trading him in the division? And that's a very fair question. I do look at it. 1 year left on his deal. He's 28. He'll turn 29 at the start of next season before he becomes an unrestricted free agent. He's making $5.5 million. So the question is, okay, hey, he's eligible for an extension on July 1st. Does LA want to lock into him long term? Does LA want to lock up Adrian Kempe long term, especially if they lose in the first round and you're basically doubling or tripling or quadrupling down on the same team that has not been able to get past the LA Kings? Now, I'm not saying trading Adrian Kempe solves their issues, but do you get in assets that you can use to address your team otherwise? Do you just need to shake things up? Do you need to make a move? And if you're a little skeptical of committing to Adrian Kempe well into his 30s, is this the logical time to trade him? Like, to me, it's almost similar to a Brock Besser situation for the Canucks coming into this season where, okay, 1 year left on his deal, you're a playoff team, so whatever, you'll see how it goes. But then all of a sudden you're staring at potentially losing him for nothing. If you're the Kings, do you want to be in this situation where it's either trade Kempe at the deadline or potentially lose him for nothing if the long-term extension isn't there? So that's why he might theoretically be available. And as for the fit, again, this guy, he really does everything you want out of a top-line winger. Can score, can play defense, plays with edge, has speed, has a relationship with Elias Pettersson. Elias Pettersson started on his line at the Four Nations. Now, don't ask me how it went, but there is at least a relationship there. So if you're keeping Pettersson, you want to do everything you possibly can to put him in a position to succeed, I think you could do a lot worse than targeting Adrian Kempe.
Yeah, first of all, I'm with you on this player. I've liked his game going back to even before he was a 70-point player, because you could see that he's got the size, he's got a heck of a shot, and what I think makes him a really good player in today's day and age is obviously the skill, but his ability to play fast. He is a transition threat all the time. And remember, a couple of years ago when it was Edmonton versus LA in the playoffs, and sure, it didn't go their way, but the transition threat going both ways. Of course, Drysdale and McDavid are elite. Kempe was not that far behind. Remember, Trevor Moore and all these guys, they can play a fast game too. And I like Kempe. He, to me, at this point in his career, and this is not a slight to the player, I think it's just an acknowledgement of, he's kind of like a slightly poorer man's Philip Forsberg.
Cat.
We're talking about a 94-point player in Philip Forsberg. Mm-hmm. Kempe is a 70-point guy. Now, yes, I think this is the type of player that Vancouver needs. Exactly the type of player Vancouver needs in terms of scoring from the wing, adding speed. Now, here's the question, though. Incentive.
How do you get him?
Incentive for LA, right?
Yep.
You've got Fiala signed long-term. You've got Anze Kopitar for another year. And who plays on his wing?
Kempe.
I think if you're trying to get the best version of Kopitar, it's going to be a heck of a deal to try to pry away his running mate, right? Like, if you're winning it for Kopi, if that's the mantra maybe in LA or Doughty or whatever, prying him away would be a very difficult proposition. You got to make it worth their while, right? This is a heck of a player, 70-point guy. What's it going to take? And that package is going to be big. You know, we were talking about Barrett Hayton and, like, you know, having a first-round pick and maybe a prospect. Kempe is going to be even a much bigger proposition.
And it's going to be fascinating to see if LA loses the series. And they might not. They're going back home, right? All they have to do is win two games at home, and they'll win this series. Edmonton still has to find a way to win in LA in order to complete the comeback here. So this might be a moot conversation, but it's going to be really interesting to see what the diagnosis is from LA's perspective if they lose this series. Like, okay, what do we do, right? We went away from the 1-3-1. We changed the coach. Now you still look at it and say, well, do you have enough dynamic attacking talent? I mean, I love the Fiala-Kempe combination on the wings at the top of the lineup and being able to split those guys up on different lines. Like, I think that's a nice wing tandem, but it's a step down from the real superstars in the NHL. Depth is a major issue right now for LA as well. Like, you look at that game last night that they played almost a full period of overtime. Sam Hellenius played 143 in the whole game, in a four period game. Yeah. Basically, he played 143. Muvarar on the back end, 225. Malott, 227. Trevor Lewis, 519. Brant Clark, 12 minutes on the blue line. Again, in a four period game, like, the bottom end of their roster, they don't trust at all. Andre Kuzmenko sat down in the third period, got some shifts in overtime when they're trying to score, but sat down in the third period. So what's the answer? Because you've got the top end issue for LA, but you also might have the depth issue. To play devil's advocate against my own position and my own pitch of Adrian Kempe, I don't know what diagnosis they'd have to have that leads to them saying, we're going to trade Adrian Kempe. I think it would just have to be as simple as, we don't want to sign him long term.
Yeah,
we're worried about that contract.
Or that you look at this from a Colorado kind of lens, where Colorado acknowledged they did not have the depth and that they were not going to sign Rantanen in long term. What did they do?
Randy, that's a better argument than I had. That's great. That's a great argument.
If you're looking to build a depth,
they went bold.
They said, hey, you know what? You're great, but you're not going to make more than Nathan McKinnon. So we're going to move you over and bring in some depth. And against Dallas right now, they're looking pretty good. So with a couple of things on Kempe, though, he's got a 10-team no-trade clause, and so does Philippe Dano.
Mm-hmm.
And I look at both of those players to say, if you're going to make a move, one wears an A, one doesn't. Dano wears an A.
Yep. Now, Dano is interesting, though. Oh, sorry, I'll let you finish.
Yeah, but I was going to say, with Dano, because he is also an interesting angle, right? Like, if you're looking to say, we need a shutdown center, sure, he's in his early 30s, but you're looking for a temporary fix to just make the toughs go away for your top centerman. You still have to play probably a good 1-2 punch, but is that another player that we look at on that roster and say, it's not a long-term fix, but it's also going to cost less because he's older? And does that address the opportunity down the middle or that gap down the middle?
So Dano is fascinating because you're right, he wears an A. So do they want to move on? And he's been such a big part of their identity, right? Kopitar, Dano.
Well, Brock Besser also wore down an the A, middle. So, but
that's a great point. Or did he sometimes? We're talking had to clarify that. Dano's been such a big part of their identity, but do they think they need to change that identity, right? And Philip Dano, he's 32, 8 goals in 80 games this year, 43 points, right? So still getting it done as a playmaker. And obviously we know it's the defensive side of things, but a 32-year-old who scored 8 goals in 80 games this year, is that what the Canucks are missing in their top six? It feels like it would very much be a plan B or C, where it's more of a stopgap solution, sure, right? Like, okay, let's at least get someone who can give us credible NHL minutes, as you said, handle those tough matchups. We know he's capable of doing that. We're not going to get the offense, but hopefully PD bounces back for that. And maybe we, you know, take a flyer on someone else at the wing to help juice our offense. It doesn't feel like a long-term solution.
No.
It feels like a short-term, okay, this is all we could do, so let's get him in and see what we can make happen.
It's essentially a two-year fix, even though he's got two more years under contract after this season. But you know what plays a huge factor in all of this, even being something that could be realistic? It's Elias Pettersson being the offensive driver on this team. Because any team, even when he was in Montreal in his younger days, mm-hmm, Dano was not going to give you offense. You need the guy that's going to be playing down the middle to drive, you know, on your first line to be that generator offense. Kopitar and Dano was a good 1-2 punch because Kopitar, for the most part, even though he's Selke level, he could pick up more of the points, right? What makes this an interesting conversation for LA, though, is Quinton Byfield ready to do that 1-2 punch with,
right,
Kopitar? And based on just the play last night, obviously that's one play in isolation.
Yep.
He's had a pretty good season otherwise. That's a part of this conversation as well. So you're right. From a Vancouver Canucks perspective, Kempe is the one I would look at. But Dano might be a piece that falls through. When we're talking about shaking it up, if Byfield is ready to take that second line role, Dano could be the player that
Dano is clearly the player that, from LA's perspective, you're like, okay, we need to change. That's the move we're making. We have Byfield. We're going to, at a certain point, you got to put the trust in Byfield,
yeah,
to do it, unless you're moving him to the wing. And then you've got a big problem you need to fill at center behind Dano and Kopitar eventually, right? Like, eventually you need to give Quinton Byfield that opportunity to step up and kind of show that he can do that. I don't know how much Philip Dano, as much as he can do as a player, really addresses specifically the needs that the Canucks have. Now,
let me pose this to you, though.
Okay.
price of acquisition.
Sure.
If it's low and you're saying, hey, it gives you a top six center, sure, not the profile that you probably need, but maybe there's, remember with Dan O, he's played with speedy wingers over the years, whether it's Trevor Moore. If you say that you're able to have him with more offensive-minded players and your play driver is actually coming from the wing,
mm-hmm.
does that change the conversation? Because I think price of acquisition for a lot of Canucks fans out there will be saying, hey, you know, is this a player that you can get? He's going to be a useful player for you, but you're not also giving up that much, right? You might be helping a division rival create some cap space, which is a problem unto itself, but at the same time, does he serve a role at a low acquisition cost?
Yeah, acquisition cost and availability is definitely the argument for Deneau. This text came in, Kempe, I love the player, but I don't see the Kings moving off him. Would think they would like to add to the group, not take away from it. But this texter does says, after taking the weekend to think about it, I am all in on both Zegras and Barrett Hayton. I would be happy with
this.
Let's
go.
So we did our job. We convinced the texter that it's Trevor Zegras.
You must have had a terrible weekend, listener. What were you thinking about on the weekend that
that just guy locked in thinking about Trevor Zegras, man? Of course. Tyler texts in, so Kempe is available to the Canucks just to see him walk in 2026. Sounds like perfect Canucks logic. Brock, Sutter, Tanev, Markstrom, etc. The only way it gets done is if LA doesn't want to extend him and Vancouver does, right? You're doing it extension in hand. You're like, hey, if Kempe's driving a hard bargain with LA and he's asking for, you know, who knows what, given his track record and his production and where the cap is going, and LA box at it and says, yeah, you know, that's going to hurt us and our ability to add to our depth. So we got to explore trading him. You have to have the extension in hand. That's how you would get the deal done. Now, you might say, well, if LA is balking at it, why would the Canucks want to do it? Because they got to take risks.
Yeah.
They have to take those risks. They have to be willing to take a swing. And if a player like Kempe becomes available, then you go for it.
And Vancouver's also in a situation where when we talk about speedy wingers or playing with speed, Vancouver doesn't have many of them, right? LA has actually got a fair number of players. Whether yep. they're as high-end as Kempe is obviously debatable, right? There's more some depth pieces, whether you look at, once you know, Fiala's a top-line player for them. Similar profile, not as big. Trevor Moore is a third-line player on that team. But you got other players. Warren Fogle is another player that's added speed. So, you know, they've got a few different other guys, but they don't have that level of skill. Vancouver doesn't have many of those profiles or any of that profile in their top six.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, desperation also leads to making these moves and why Vancouver would say, hey, maybe it might be something that could work in Vancouver, and why LA would say, yeah, we've got similar players. We've got players that can you know, play a certain style. There's a number that we don't want to pass. Or to your point, I think the desperation factor of, you don't get it done 4 years in a row, if this happens this year, is that going to force change?
Because, what do you do? Like, do you make some irrational decisions?
But here's the thing. One thing we haven't talked about. There's going to be pressure on Rob Blake. There's going to be some serious pressure on him. I think it's actually even worthy of asking, is his job on the line after
sure.
this postseason if they fail to Edmonton?
Well, I think back, and I don't know if it's quite at this level, right? Because it has been first-round series, and you know, no one's necessarily looked at LA as a cup contender in this span. Or at least a bona fide one. But we think back to the 3 in a row Canucks versus the Blackhawks. And what was the conversation going into the 2011 series? Okay, if you lose, and especially when we got to game 7, right? And is if you blow a 3-0 series lead against the Blackhawks, lose for the third straight year, that felt like D-Day for the franchise, right?
Players
like,
in the room acknowledge that, well, after
like,
the fact.
Who's going to be here? Coach, gone. GM, potentially gone. Major players, Kessler, gone. Luongo, right? Like, that was the stakes of that game. Again, I don't know if it's that level for LA, but anytime you lose 4 times to the same straight team, how can you possibly have any approach other than we have to consider everything? Everything has to be on the table for what we're doing going forward.
No doubt. And of those moves, like Kempe to me, I think is the, of the two, is still the unlikely.
Yes.
However,
and I acknowledge that, but we're trying to, brainstorming. We're blue skying it here.
But if I'm, you know, in the Rogers Tower at Rogers Arena, and you're saying ideal scenario, like if something happens in LA, if Rob Blake is let go and there's a new manager and he sees the world differently and they see
yeah.
that roster differently, or if it's that manager who's feeling the heat,
look, let's say LA loses, okay, this series, I'm making the call. I'm calling Rob Blake. Like, hey man, what are you thinking? Kempe, extension eligible. You think you're going to get it done?
Yeah.
We'd love to pay him. Like, you're at least making the call. It might be a short call. It might be Rob Blake saying, no, he's part of the solution. We love him. Sorry. Hey, what about Philip Deneau? But you have to at least make the call in that conversation. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. People are texting in, some with alternate ideas.
I was going to say, either you say to Rob Blake, give me Adrian Kempe or give me Alex Laferriere. One of those two guys. I like him
sure.
as a player.
I like Laferriere. This text comes in. I can't see Kempe being traded. Alex Tuch feels more realistic. So Tuch, obviously in Buffalo, does wear an A there. Local connection as well. So yeah, you can always look at Buffalo and wonder, what are they going to do? Are they going to do something wild? Are they going to do something irrational? But even Alex Tuch with 1 year left on his deal, again, great player. It would be a fantastic fit for the Vancouver Canucks. But given the local connections, I don't see Alex Tuch really being on the market. I don't see him being any more available necessarily than Adrian Kempe would be.
Those rumblings were coming around at the trade deadline, though, even this past season, of is he a guy that could be on the move?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why. Like, if you're a Buffalo executive, or if you're Terry Pegula there, you're saying, we want guys that want to play in Buffalo. Like, it's difficult to get players to go there. But if he's available, yeah, that's a player that, you know, he's maybe not to the level of the Kempes of the world. But is he more attainable?
Mm-hmm.
Is he bringing speed? He's 6'4". He's got the size. He's burned the Canucks going back to his Vegas days. Simple alley-oop plays through the neutral zone, hitting that with speed and getting behind the defense. Like, that's the type of player they need.
The somebody else texted in, and I don't have it in front of me now, so apologies for not giving credit to the texter, but that Jesperi Kotkaniemi is the best buy low option. Still only 24, and I know his name has kind of become synonymous with, oh, never lived up to the hype of his draft stock and that long-term contract. You don't like that. The way the cap has gone up now, all of a sudden, 4.8 for a 24-year-old to 2030, there is an element there where in a couple of years, that's going to be third-line center money, right? And it's like, okay, hey, if he never takes that next step where we feel good about him as a top-six player, whether it's on the wing or at center, at least we have him locked up at totally fine third line center money. We know there's been interest in the past from the Canucks on Jesperi Kotkaniemi. That again feels like not the big splashy one that everyone would love and get the headlines. But if you go through the, you know, if you make the call to Kempe and it's a short conversation and it's a no, and you're going down your list and you're getting a lot of no's at the top, eventually you land on Kotkaniemi. And I do think there's some reason to explore that. As much as it gets a negative backlash when we bring the name up, people are very polarized against Kotkaniemi. I do think there's some reason, there's some logic to look at it.
I think as a third line center, he'd be great. But if you're looking for that player to make a leap, he's gotten moments in his Carolina career to kind of play that second line center role, and really kind of, you know, his ceiling's been about 40 points, 43 points, right? So that's the player that I look at and say, yeah, you're probably taking 7 or 8 no's before you get to Jesperi Kotkaniemi. I'm not totally all that hot on that idea. I know that name has been out there. Third line center, fine. But for what this team needs right now, is he a slight upgrade over Teddy Bluger? Like, production-wise.
Absolutely.
He is. He's younger. Yeah. Don't get me wrong. But, like, as far as production is going,
sure,
like, that's not what this team needs right now. Like, a slight upgrade on Teddy Bluger.
But do you get someone who at least has the potential to be more? That, and again, I'm not saying it's plan A, but plan B, C, D, maybe. But you have to look at that.
Here's why I would look at this to say maybe, because Bluger is also a UFA after this year.
Sure.
So you're essentially saying, hey, is this an opportunity to have a replacement in-house? If I'm Atu Ratu, I'm probably saying, what about me over here? But we'll see.
By the way, and I can't confirm this, but multiple people texting in that apparently Alex Tuch's wife is from the Lower Mainland. So Lena's nodding her head yes. So Lena's got the WAG report nailed down. She
insiders,
can confirm.
Love it.
The WAG insider, Lena, producer Lena. So there you go. Just something to think about, I
and
guess.
Come on, it's courtesy Vancouver versus inbox. Buffalo. Like, Niagara Falls is nice and all, guys, but maybe for like 3 days.
All right, keep sending your text in, 650-650 to the Dunbar Lumber text line. Kevin Woodley is going to join us next. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these podcasts. popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. Kevin Woodley next on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. To Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Randeep Janda are here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics, working together with you in step 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Send your thoughts in. Manny Malhotra is going to join us at 1:30. Of course, head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks. Do we have Woodley ready to go? But joining us right now from NHL.com and InGoal Magazine, he is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is Kevin Woodley. Woodley, thanks for doing this as always. How are you?
I'm good. I guess it'd be worse if I was coming after Manny, as opposed to the billing I just got. Like, stick around.
No,
we've got... coming in half an hour.
I'm plugging the rest of the show. We've got an incredible 1-2 punch of guests in this hour. That's how I'm framing it, Woodley.
Well, I think so highly of Manny. I haven't had a chance to talk to him at all this year on the coaching side. Obviously, he's done a wonderful job, but I'll be listening to that interview as well. One of the... just an absolute treat to cover his career, and it's been kind of fun from a distance, because Abbotsford is a distance yes. To watch the success he's having in his first year out there.
Well, Kevin, we don't see it this way as you as the opener. You're the co-headliner, my friend, so come on, lean into it. You're good.
Well, and I got to say, Woodley, I mean, to be perfectly honest, and I'll give full credit to producer Lena here, to me, one, we want to talk Abby Canucks. That's one of the number one stories today, but the other big story, I think, coming out of the Stanley Cup playoffs is Connor Hellebuyck, and who better to get into it than with you. So, I mean, it's the question everyone's asking, certainly in Winnipeg, but I think across the league, getting pulled in two straight games in St. Louis, like, what is going on with presumptive Vezina winner Connor Hellebuyck right now?
One of the greatest readers of the game, his ability to anticipate plays, to connect the patterns of the game in front of him and apply his system. And so what do you do when you face a goalie that anticipates and reads and identifies things at a level, you know, I say, like we always used to say of Hasek, he had a brain like a computer and a body like a slinky, and Helly has the brain like a computer. Doesn't use his body like a slinky behind it, but he has that processing. So how do you beat that guy? 14 goals so far in the playoffs. 5 are on broken plays, so scrambles, right? Like pucks off bodies, legs, in front of him, sticks that never actually reach him. A rebound is one thing. A rebound you can feel. You know where it's headed next. You can't with a broken play. It's basically chaos. So 5 out of 14 are on broken plays. And what's the other thing you do with a goalie who reads the game exceptionally well? You take away his eyes. 4 screen goals so far. So that's 9 of the 14 goals on basically 2 elements of play style that don't allow him to do the things that he relies on to succeed anywhere near the degree he is used to doing them. And so, you know, part of that, we saw that last year, right? Like Colorado created laterals off screens. Like in screens can, we often think of screens as being when a shot is coming. But we've seen a number of times, you know, I think of the Edmonton series, there's a couple of goals where Skinner in the first two games is late getting across. And I was like, why is he so late? Well, it's because he never saw this pass because of the screen. So they've done a really good job, the Blues. And this blueprint was built by Colorado. And I guess the question is, how does Winnipeg defend it? How does Connor Hellebuyck adapt to it? Like, you don't change your game. You just have to find a way to see more of these pucks and survive behind this chaos. And the reality is, for 2 straight years now, teams are doing so much more they're so much more focused at creating that chaos in the playoffs, in particular, knowing that it's Connor Hellebuyck they have to beat. And so I don't have the answers on how you fix that, but it's pretty clear a pattern for each of the past two seasons that is working, you know, at a level that has everyone surprised. And, you know, maybe we shouldn't be. I do think when I look at his regular season numbers, like, he's still above expected, although only slightly on screens. He's above expected on broken plays. I just think the purposefulness with which teams try to create those types of plays in the playoffs gets ramped up. And it's impossible to sort of replicate that during a regular season. Because, I mean, you guys know this. You've lived playoff hockey. You've watched it. You've covered it somewhat rarely of late in these parts. But that intensity is just like guys don't go to the net with the same type of intensity and purpose in the regular season that we see them do it in the playoffs. And so he's underperformed behind it, but it's mostly in the areas that I think most people would regard as, again, not weaknesses, because he's still good in the regular season, but relative to everything else he does so well, they're relative weaknesses. Deflections as well. One of the only stat all season that he was under expected this year is deflections. So those are the types of ways to beat one of the best in the world. And I just think the purposefulness with which teams attack in those regards in the postseason goes up a notch.
Yeah, I find this whole situation really fascinating, because I think especially looking at the series last year against Colorado, and it was, you know, a nightmare from allowing goals, but you also watched that series and it was like, oh my gosh, Colorado's just carving them up. These are incredible grade A opportunities. Like, you can't expect Connor Hellebuyck to be Superman and stop all of these. And, you know, as you're describing, like, St. Louis is doing some things really effectively to make life difficult for him and getting good looks against Winnipeg. But to me, that almost raises a further question, which is, from Winnipeg's perspective, like, every team has flaws, every goalie has flaws. Why are teams apparently so able, once the playoffs roll around, to effectively target A, Hellebuyck's flaws, but also to break down your defense in such a way that they're able to expose Connor Hellebuyck a little bit in the playoffs? Like, why is it like a, not just for Connor Hellebuyck, but almost for the team, it's like a switch is flipping when it comes to the playoffs and other teams are able to so effectively attack them and break them down?
Well, I do think the previous comment holds in some of those regards, right? Like, the how hard teams are willing to work to get to those areas goes up a notch in the playoffs. And so, do you have the ability to prevent them from doing so? Do you have the ability to sort of match that intensity around the front of your net to win those battles that you've been winning all season? And the other thing, too, is, like, I think a lot of that holds true for last year, Jamie, just because of the volume with which Colorado created those chances. But I'm with you on this one. Like, it's not like St. Louis is caving them in with these chances, just they're going in at such a high rate. And so, please don't take everything I'm saying about why pucks are going in to say they should be at the rate they are, right? Like, he's better than this. I do think we've seen, you know, even in some of the one-on-one situations, was it Thomas that was the trailer that basically ended up with a breakaway going to the net?
Yes.
Was that I couldn't remember Neighbors or Thomas. And so on that play, if you really watch the freeze frame on it, like, Hellebuyck is usually so good at one-on-ones. And again, reading releases and reading body language, hips, hands, everything. Like, his abilities in those regards are uncanny. I've done video with him where he is calling not just shot or pass, but where the shot is going within a stride and a half of the guy coming over the blue line. He doesn't release it to the dot, but he's got it identified exactly why. And then you watch that play, you know, and you can look at other elements of that play, like Kyle Connor with just a brutally off-target pass off the boards, which leads to that rush. Connor being late getting back, so that when Thomas, as the trailer, is skating in, Connor's too far behind to affect him. So there are other guys that play a role in this. But at the end of the day, as Thomas comes in, Hellebuyck actually shifts to his left. Like, he reads shot to his glove side, and he actually starts to move left right before and just as Robert Thomas cuts back to the middle and across through the crease, tapping in on the backside, whether it went off DeMello or not. So irregardless, like, Hellebuyck either committed to, biting on, or anticipating a shot to his glove side and actually start. We've seen the differences. Like, I know a lot of people pointed at the Kyrou goal in game one, the one from just inside the point. Again, there's been so many goals from so many. This isn't a Connor Hellebuyck shot. This is for so many teams because there's so much hockey on. Like this weekend, I'm trying to make sure that I'm remembering the right one. But it was a point shot in the first game. And I do think it was Kyrou where Hellebuck's so deep and he flattens out his backside like he's not even square on the puck. And everyone's like, what's he doing? Like he's playing so deep. That's not how he normally is. And by the way, yes, it is. He always plays deep. I think he's actually, if you look, I think he's a step ahead of it, and what he thinks is going to happen doesn't happen. Neighbors is cutting back door on that play. I'm pretty sure he flattens. I'm willing to bet that when they did video on this, and Wade Flaherty asked him why he was dropping his backside leg and flattening out his coverage when the puck is coming from his left, he anticipated a backdoor pass from two neighbors. Streaking to his backside and flattened out to prepare for that. Kyrou delivers a high shot through traffic that beats him. And so it's a hat tip for a great shot, but also that fine line between being able to read the game and anticipate what's coming next. And frankly, for lack of a better term, cheating towards it. And more than I can recall in recent memory, he's on the wrong side of that line where he is just cheating a little bit towards what he expects to happen rather than staying on the puck and tracking what's happening in front of him. And it's a tough balance. He normally does it better than, like I said, anyone in the game, arguably as well as anyone in the history of the game when you look at the success he's had. But right now, he is on the wrong side of that pendulum a little bit. You see it in the release. His patience is, you know, a staple of his game off the release. And you see him right now, before the puck's off the stick, the hands are pulling in. Like, he's not waiting as long as he normally does off an open release to react to the puck. And that's just, I don't have an answer for it, but it's not what he does when he's at his best. And obviously, he's not at his best right now. And the last little thing I'd point out here, because he was so incredible in the calendar year 2020. He was so good, we wrote a story about it. Like, his 2024 calendar year was at the levels we've never seen before. Since January 1st, however, his adjusted save percentage is, you know, plus 0.5, which means he's basically saving you like half a goal for every 100 shots. And at his best, it's closer to 2 goals. Like, that's where the top of the league is. And it ranks 23rd. And so as good as he was in totality and as much as he's going to win a second Vezina trophy, the play kind of fell off in the second half of this season from the lofty heights of the first half and of 2024. And, you know, this is obviously an extreme, more than a continuation. But he hasn't been that guy really to the level he was in 2024 for a couple months now.
Okay, when we look at, you know, his play and the way he was used down the stretch, and there's certain people in hockey saying, hey, does he need to get to that number of 60? Why are they playing him in these games down the stretch? Does that take a toll here, or is this completely separate in your opinion, Kevin?
I don't have the answer, Randy. Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I did get to spend a little time with him and Wade Flaherty and Eric Comrie when they were through town here. And obviously that was after Four Nations and, you know, sort of amid that stretch. And I heard some of that noise. And all I can say is that, you know, I don't think he ever felt that way in any shape or form. As a matter of fact, when talking about the Four Nations, he was the only goalie I'd talked to that just was like, yeah, it was three more games. Would have liked it. He would have liked it to have been one more game. I don't think he wanted the rest. Remember, they sat him for a game, mm-hmm. gave him a game off. I don't think he wanted that. Like, it's funny because he's a technician. Every goalie relies on rhythm and timing and reads to varying degrees, and normally the technicians rely less on it. And yet, I think, despite being more of a technical goaltender, that anticipation, like, I just think he feels better about it when he's playing a lot. And I had no sense. Like, he came back, his complaints about Four Nations, and complaints isn't the right word, I'm sorry, I shouldn't use that one, but like, his observations about it were, the only inconveniences to him were making sure, you know, more about making sure the family had everything they needed, you know, when they were in the same city and making sure that was all taken care of. It wasn't about the hockey. And so I can understand why everyone looks at it and says, well, nobody plays this much and he keeps falling off in the playoffs. And so you need to change that. And if it, and if they don't get through this, maybe they have to, just to see if it looks any different. But in a lot of these cases, you know, even during the regular season, when we talk about resting goalies and workload and things like that, to me, it's always about the relationship with the goalie coach and having a true understanding of what your guy looks like at his best. And I know we don't get to see this, but they go to great lengths to make sure his practice time is like highly focused when he's out there, and that he's not out there as much as a lot of other goaltenders around the league. Like, they really manage that carefully, to the point of having, you know, goalie-specific practice sessions and then not having him out there for the rest of team practice. And so when I hear I hear about those efforts and I hear what he says and how he feels, you know, just like a month before the playoffs, where everyone else, even goalies that didn't play in the Four Nations, are getting time off, and he's just feeling like, yeah, no big deal, I'm not tired at all. I wonder if that's actually the problem here. So it's an easy narrative. At the end of the day, the only way we probably ever get an answer is if they limit him to 50 games next year and he has more success. But when you talk to him, and for a guy that thinks the game as well as he does and knows his body as well as he does, because he's very in tune with all the biomechanics of everything he does, I don't get the sense in his mind that any way, shape, or form this is a fatigue issue.
Woodley, elsewhere in the Stanley Cup playoffs, obviously in the Edmonton-LA series, Edmonton makes the switch to Calvin Pickard for Game 3. Now, they've won both Game 3 and 4 with him in net over Stuart Skinner. Last year in the playoffs, we saw them go to Pickard, then go back to Skinner. Feels like that's not imminent this time around with the results. What has allowed Pickard to have relatively more success against LA through two games than Skinner?
A 904 expected save percentage compared to Stuart Skinner's 872.
There you go.
Right, like, and this is not a slight on Calvin Pickard, because the one thing he's done, especially in Game 1, no goals on high-danger chances. Some low-danger ones, and that's why his overall numbers actually aren't that impressive. He's still well under expected for the two games. Some mid-danger ones. Two on 10 high-danger chances last night. But, you know, when Knobloch said after Game 1 and heading into Game 2, when he was asked about the goaltend, he talked about those, and nobody likes to hear the phrases like timely saves. You're allowed to stop the high danger ones too. And Stu was struggling with that. They were all high danger for the most part, especially the first game. It was all six were high danger chances, but and he actually made 8 saves, like, because they just got outplayed so badly. But you're allowed to stop those two. And Cal's done a better job of that so far. And they can, you know, normally when you give up the low danger stuff, you don't win those games, but they've been able to overcome that. And I said this during the regular season, it was really hard to tell how much of it was the team and how much of it was just opponents and situations, but there was a 20-point gap in expected save percentage between Pickard and Skinner during the year. And at some point the question becomes, are they playing better for this guy? For whatever reason, are they playing better for this guy? And Chris Knobloch kind of said it after Game 1. For whatever reason, we seem to play better, at least defensively, when Calvin Pickard's in net. I'm paraphrasing, but that's what I heard when I saw the highlight. And I'm like, yeah, that's what the numbers have said all year, the numbers I have. And I've had this discussion on Edmonton Radio, and I couldn't figure out why. Because it's not uncommon. I mean, back-to-backs, different opponents, like, you can see this happen. But now we're two games in against the same opponent, and there's a 32-point difference between the environment Stuart Skinner has faced and the environment that Calvin Pickard has faced. And so it doesn't matter by how much Calvin Pickard's outperforming Stuart Skinner, because the margins are probably a lot smaller than people would expect based on the results. But as long as the team's playing better in front of him, that gives them their best chance to win. And, you know, it seems almost like a bit of a chicken poop answer, but the numbers back it up. They play better defensively for this guy, and they have in the first four games of these playoffs, as well as the regular season.
Kevin, I did want to switch to the Canucks before we let you go here. Abbotsford Canucks, of course, they win their first round series against Tucson. Now they've got Coachella Valley coming up. And Artur Shelov's 921 save percentage in that series, 2 wins, 1 loss. But, you know, what could a deep run here in the AHL playoffs mean for this guy and the season that he had at the NHL level and at the AHL level?
I guess confidence. You know, you can get confidence from it. Maybe you get the confidence back of the organization because it seems pretty clear that that's been lost to an extent. Beyond that, you know, we've talked about this before. The American Hockey League and the NHL for goalies are different games, right? Like, you either figure it out or you don't at some point. And it'll be interesting to see how many more chances he gets to figure it out at the NHL level. And we've talked, it's no secret, you know, what parts of the game plague him there. I've got to try and get down there to watch some of the games. I watched one late in the regular season against, I believe it was Calgary, the Wranglers. I went down and Arturs was playing and he had a weird decision on a breakaway where he basically could have handled the puck well before the guy got to it, waited too late and then threw his stick at him and ended up with a penalty shot that went in, had some screen goals go in where again, that same thing we saw at the National Hockey League level. You know, he had one start this year where I thought it looked like he'd figured out the tracking component and the moving into pucks off distance shots as opposed to dropping and opening up. And then the next game, it disappeared. To me, those are the elements that if he continues to improve on are sort of the next step that it's required at the NHL because clearly teams are going to try and beat him with, you know, more distance shots and a lot of traffic and tips. One of the hardest parts of the game today. We started this segment talking about Connor Hellebuck, the quote-unquote greatest goalie in the league, struggling with it, right? So there's a learning component to how to manage those things. How many more shots will he get at that with this organization? Yeah, maybe a good playoff run gives them more confidence in him. There are things you can do differently. I just haven't seen enough of those things taking hold in his game. I didn't see it late in the regular season. I only saw glimpses of it when he was up in the NHL. And so the question becomes, A, are they even working on those things? And then B, is he able to translate that effectively in the American Hockey League playoffs? And maybe that helps him when he gets up here. Because to be honest with you, other than that, the game's just so different down there. We see a lot of goalies. You see it with Akira Schmid and the Vegas Golden Knights. Hey, by the way, like we talk about goalies struggling early in the playoffs, Aiden Hill is one of several big names along with Connor Hellebuck, Linus Allmark, and even Andre Vasilevsky are at the bottom of those rankings adjusted wise so far in the playoffs. We might see more Akira Schmid in the NHL before these playoffs are done. And he's a guy that in the chaos of the American Hockey League, where the game is largely about mistakes being made, he struggles mightily, but put him in the NHL where there's more control and he's just fine. So I don't put a ton of weight, but it's never a bad thing for your confidence. And in this case, maybe you can win over the confidence of some others in the organization to earn another shot as they build out maybe some of the decisions this summer about how they build out their depth chart. The other thing, too, is other teams are watching, right? That's the last component. Mm-hmm. If you can maybe create some confidence in other teams, then maybe you get another shot elsewhere on waivers. Because right now, I think it'd be clear, you know, based on this past season especially, pretty easily and be down in the American Hockey League to start next year.
Woodley, great stuff as always. You crushed it as the co-headliner of this hour of Canucks Talk. So thank you, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George in White Rock or whiterockhyundai.com, and we will talk to the other headliner of this hour of Canucks Talk next year. Manny Malhotra, Abbotsford Canucks head coach, fresh off a round one win in the Calder Cup playoffs, looking ahead to round two now against the Coachella Valley Firebirds. We'll chat with Manny about that matchup, about the season as a whole, some of the individual players that have been key for Abbotsford as well. That's next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda here. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. Manny Malhotra, head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks, is going to join us momentarily here on the show. And, of course, his team, winners of a big, decisive Game 3, 5-0 over Tucson in the first round of the Calder Cup playoffs. And as a result, they advance now to Round 2, best-of-five series against the Coachella Valley Firebirds. And now joining us on the line, again, he is the head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks, Manny Malhotra. Manny, thanks very much for doing this today. How are you?
I'm feeling good, guys. How about yourself?
We're doing very well. So, first of all, congratulations on the round one win over Tucson. And, you know, a decisive, emphatic victory in game three of that series, which is a winner-go-home game, 5-0. What went right for your team in that game on Saturday?
I think the response that we had was exactly what we have grown to be as a team. If you look up and down the lineup, starting in net, obviously, Artie did a great job shutting the door for us. He played a real poised and composed game. And then as you go throughout the lineup, everybody on the front end, everybody on the back end was able to contribute something from a physicality standpoint, from an energy standpoint. I think just the overall response that we got as a group was exactly what we wanted to see out of our guys in a critical game.
And I haven't been able to make it out to Abbotsford for a playoff game yet, but from what I've seen, from what I've heard, great atmosphere with the fans in support of the Abbey Canucks. What was it? What's the environment been like, and how great is it for your players to be able to experience that playoff intensity, playoff atmosphere?
Yeah, leading up to the playoffs, I heard nothing but great stories about the crowds here. The guys were talking about it. RJ's been talking about it, and it definitely lived up to the hype. The energy in the building was outstanding. The numbers that were through the door was great. And I can't stress this enough, and I don't know how much fans will read into it, but our guys drew off the energy that they had in a big way. So it was a great playoff-type environment. They were loud. They were cheering at the right time. It was a great great spectacle for our guys, and they had the energy to get through it.
Yeah, well, one of the guys that was definitely feeding off the energy was Sammy Blais, obviously a cup winner. He had 3 power play goals for you in this series as well. Just from, you know, day one of the season, of course, he was in the conversation to make the NHL club early on. He doesn't do that, but, like, what has he meant to your team, not only in this playoff series, but overall, just through the entirety of the season?
Well, if you go through the course of it, I think you started off by saying, you know, he's won a cup. So that in itself, guys look at him, they look up to him, and they look to him as a leader, and they just want to see, you know, what it takes to be at the next level. Obviously, he's played 300 games in the NHL, so they wanted to understand why and how he did it. And then as you come into playoff time now, he's found another gear, and he has elevated his game to kind of that playoff standard, playoff mentality. And he was definitely a catalyst for us on Saturday night. He had a couple big hits early on that the fans went crazy for, and his play, he was just heavy on pucks, and obviously had another power play goal. So everything about his game was playoff based. So just leading by example for him, he did a great job for us.
Manny, obviously, you know, the goal is of course to win at the AHL level, but development is a key thing as well. And, you know, even from your perspective, this is your first year as a head coach at the pro level. What have you learned? How have you grown as a coach over the course of this season with Abbotsford?
Well, every day for me has been a learning experience. The on-ice stuff, the being in intense situations at the end of a game, up or down, you know, practice or planning out kind of weeks as we go, planning out months and practices. And then obviously learning the different personalities that we have on the team. That for me is a big part of it, is just understanding the players that we have. So I've grown immensely as a coach. I've grown immensely as a person. And it's been an awesome experience for me. I've been fortunate to have a great staff to work with. And then obviously the players here the growth that they've showed over the course of the year, it's been a lot of fun to work with.
We've talked with Abbey Canucks GM Ryan Johnson on this show before, and he's referred to the AHL as an after-Christmas league, where you really start to get a sense of the level and the quality of teams and the performances you're going to get from certain players after Christmas. And, of course, your team in the latter half of the season this year rattled off a 13-game winning streak, caught fire, obviously. What went into that to putting yourself in a position to go on that sort of streak at that point in the season?
Well, I think it speaks to a number of things. Number one, it speaks to the depth of this group. If you look at our lineup throughout the course of that run, we had guys get called up, guys get sent down, we had guys injured, we had guys sick. But we were able to maintain that standard of play and get the results we needed. So, number one, it speaks to the depth of our guys. And then two, I keep using the word and keep coming back to it, is the growth of our group. Throughout the course of the season, we had a lot of ups and downs, and we went through some tough patches. And over the last month and a half or so, we've truly found our identity as a team and have a great understanding of what makes us work, what we look like when we're going well. We have a great understanding of our systems and what we want to do and why we want to do certain things. And the guys have really taken ownership of their game, and they've been pushing one another to be successful and be the team we are right now.
Well, you mentioned, getting players back from the NHL. You got 7 right before the playoffs started, which is great. It's a great problem to have as a head coach, where you've got an influx of, players that you trust all season long coming back to the club. But the team was also clicking. How do you balance those roster decisions when you've got a group that's feeling great, but you've got some high-impact players coming back to your league?
It's a very difficult situation to be in. But as you said, it's a nice problem to have. Again, speaking to the depth of our group, that we have 7 guys that were up in the NHL that can come back and at various times in the season were key factors in our success and key factors in getting us to where we are right now. So obviously there's some tough conversations with guys that obviously all of a sudden find themselves down the lineup or out of the lineup. But again, at the end of the day, the guys understand the decisions that are made. They don't have to be happy with them, but one thing that we've stressed all year long and one thing that continued to take place with those changes and the guys coming back was that we maintain a positive attitude around here. Guys, it's fine for them to be out of the lineup, but it doesn't give them a green light to be grumps around the room or to be energy sucks in any way, shape, or form. So the guys that have come out have displayed a positive attitude and are all about winning and just have continued to be good in the locker room, good on the ice, which is all we could ask for.
Well, some of those players, got an extended run in the NHL that ended up coming back to your team. Others got maybe a couple of games here and there. What have you seen? What kind of impact have you seen on maybe their mentality, their play? But what do you hope they also take away from that experience of playing in the National League?
Well, I think the biggest thing about getting an opportunity to play at that level is you understand how fast and how strong and how intense the game is. A puck battle is not just a puck battle. When you're going against an NHL veteran defenseman who, understands the game, understands how to gain leverage on somebody, you understand that all of a sudden it's not just about being heavy on your stick. It's about body positioning and angles. And there's so many things that go into it. It's not just, putting your stick on the ice and going to play. So I think the guys that did come back have a very good understanding or a better understanding of how difficult that next level is, and have a much greater appreciation for it. And you could see them apply it into their own game here. Their practice habits are dialed in, their energy in games and how heavy they are during the course of a game kind of emulates what they took away from with the Canucks.
in conversation with Manny Malhotra, Abbotsford Canucks head coach here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. And Manny, you mentioned earlier that learning about the different personalities in your group and how to effectively manage different personalities as a head coach was a big part of the season for you. How has that element changed from your playing days? I think it's often something that's not front of mind for fans, right? We tend to focus on, you know, who's getting the ice time as a coaching decision and tactics and all that. But the behind the scenes management and personnel management, I know, is a huge part of the job. How has that changed since your playing days?
In a lot of ways, it hasn't changed much. Players just want the information. And I can remember being on the other side of the door in the locker room and just wanting to know where I stood in all situations. If I was coming out of the lineup, or if I was, you know, being put on a different line, or if I had a different role, just give me the reasons and the understanding. And it's no different for these guys right now. They just want to know the information, good or bad. They want the input on their game. How can I improve? What do I need to do to get more ice? How can I get myself into this situation? So for me in this role now, it's all about communicating with the guys and having real open lines of communication, and being very honest with them. Everybody, you know, it's difficult to fool a player. So if you ever try to sugarcoat things or, you know, kind of skew the story, they read right through it. So this brutal and honesty is what they're looking for. So that hasn't changed much.
Well, let's talk about a couple of the players as well. I want to talk to you about Victor Mancini, because I was in Abbotsford for game two to watch that game. And I got to say, at the NHL level, maybe understandably, probably playing a little bit more safe. You know, you mentioned earlier getting used to the speed and understanding leverage at the NHL level. But at the AHL level, like, he's a puck dominant player. He's, you know, attacking the blue paint a lot more. What have you noticed from him over the last maybe month or so? And where do you want him to go with this game?
Well, his ability to move around the ice is obviously an asset for him. He's a big body. When you have a defenseman of that size and that range that can move around the ice very well, it's obviously a major asset. So he's done a good job. As you said, he does a good job with the puck on his stick, and he moves puck up the ice, and he advances play for us. But that's not the end all and be all, and that's not what we want him to primarily focus on. His overall game is pretty unique, and he does a good job of it at the NHL level. As you said, he plays probably a little bit more safe than he would like to. At this level, you know, he needs to adopt some of that of just taking care of the details at certain times defensively. And then, you know, as he does those things, he'll get more and more opportunities to attack on the offensive side of things. But we're not just looking at him as, okay, we want you to rush the puck up every time. There will be those opportunities for him just because of the way he moves. But just his overall defensive game and being solid is an area of focus for not only him, but all of our D.
Another player I want to talk about, and I think you are the perfect person to talk about this attribute of Atu Ratu's game. There's only a few players that have dominated the faceoff circle like you in NHL history. Where does he stack up? He's already at 57% this year at the NHL level. Like, you know, when you watch him, could he be one of the most dominant guys in the NHL? And what, you know, as somebody who's a, you know, a master of that trait, like, what do you watch when you watch him take draws?
Well, he has obviously a couple of different techniques that he uses. So that versatility is perhaps why he's had so much success so far. It's difficult for other players to get a read on what he's doing. But I think the next step for him is just understanding and developing a book on guys. When it's difficult to take just a couple draws a game, and then you're going through the league and you're playing against different guys every night. But once you start to develop kind of a system in your head and a book on guys and how you want to take a face-off on the right versus a lefty versus a face-off on the left versus a righty, all those kinds of things come into play. But yeah, he's done a good job of developing his own skills. Now for him, it's a matter of the repetition and just understanding the little nuances and techniques against certain guys.
So, Manny, your Calder Cup playoffs continue with a matchup against the Coachella Valley Firebirds. First two games in Coachella, and then back here for as many as three in Abbotsford, if needed, in the best of five series. What are you stressing to your team ahead of the matchup with Coachella Valley?
Well, I think this nothing really changes for us in the mindset of how we want to prepare and how we want to play. Obviously, the stakes are much higher this time of year, but our focus or our daily focus here for the majority of the season, and it seems to have worked for us, is just being just focused on the next one. And obviously they're a team that's been to the finals 2 years in a row, so they understand how to play at this time of year, and they're a very structured and direct team. So for us, it's a matter of executing the game plan that has allowed us to be successful over the last 6 to 8 weeks, and just being the aggressors in the game. We don't want to just allow them time and space. We want to be able to be the aggressors in every aspect. The forecheck game, we want to keep them under duress in their zone, and now you limit time that they get on the offensive side of things.
Manny, really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today. Again, congratulations on the round one win, and best of luck in round two.
Appreciate it, guys. Have a great day.
Thank you. That is Manny Malhotra, of course, former Vancouver Canuck and now head coach of the Abbotsford Canucks, weighing in on very impressive first season as an AHL, as a professional head coach, that he's been able to author with the Abbotsford Canucks. And you brought up the faceoffs with Atu Ratu, and I just pulled up Hockey Reference. The first year with the Canucks, 61.7% in the dot, over 60%. And you know, like, how many of those were D-zone against the other team's best line or second best line, penalty kill in the D-zone? Like, those were hard, big-time draws. 61.7% for Manny Malhotra in 2010-2011.
The season before that, he was 62.5% with San Jose. So, like, that wasn't even his best season.
A career, unreal. Simply unreal.
And 56.4% as a career. But, like, remember, it's not like he started off being a face-off specialist.
No.
He had to master that craft, kind of what he was talking about with Atu Ratu, right? Like, now you have to have a book on guys. What are their tendencies? And rather than taking the draw occasionally, like, this is your job. And Ratu's done a good job thus far, 57%. But, you know, when you're facing off against Ryan O'Reilly, Bo Horvat, JT Miller, those guys are going to have a book on you.
Yes.
And you got to have one on them.
Yeah. Man, he was so good. That's a wild number.
Even after his injury, he was hitting
still
like 60%.
59-60%. Yeah. That's just wild. Incredible to be able to sustain that again, specifically in the types of draws that he was taking in a massive volume as well. And just in general, the takeaway, I mean, the face-offs thing is fun, but you listen to Malhotra, hard not to be extremely impressed with the mindset, the attitude, and everything that he has brought to the Abbotsford Canucks, right? Just saying, hey, it's all about a growth mindset for him as well. Talking very openly about how he's grown, how he's learned as a rookie head coach at the professional level. And, you know, we don't have to turn this into a speculation what if Rick Tocchet leaves thing, because only 1 year on the job for Manny Malhotra with Abbotsford. But just as an asset to have in your organization, we already have seen it pay dividends with the way certain guys were able to come up and slide into the lineup in moments of crisis for the NHL Canucks this year. To have a coaching prospect like that in your organization is a massive asset for the Canucks.
Oh, for sure. And whether it's at the AHL level, of course, Manny was an associate coach on Travis Green's staff going back as well. But leaders start on the bench. Like, your coach has to be the best leader.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not expecting them to, you know, jump into every conversation. You train the leaders. Hopefully you have a number of different leaders on the team and the coach can take a step back. But what do we know about Manny? Manny Malhotra is one of the best leaders in Vancouver Canucks history. Go back to that 2011 team. A lot of people from that team will say he was destined to be a coach. He was one of the main guys on that team. So I think the ability to have buy-in from players and talking to some of the guys in Abbotsford, this is a coach that is fully, you know, just involved in every aspect of improving players' games and making sure that they have their best foot forward, that they're able to produce at the highest levels, even down to his gym, like, ability,
yes.
Right? Like, talking to some of the guys, he's working out with them. He's doing the exact same stuff they are. Like, he is ripped at this age, retired, coaching well into his coaching career, And like when guys see that and say, all right, this not just guy with the standing next to the clipboard.
If you're making the jump from, you know, the dub to the AHL and you see your coach going like that, like, oh, man, I got to raise my standards here.
And we generally think of coaches of like, you know, 50 plus overweight guy that's just bossing people around. Wouldn't be able to do a jumping jack to save his life, even, right? Or a squat or hit a squat rack. Manny's outworking some of his players, man.
I feel like Rod the Bod set that new standard where it's like you have to be able to like go toe to toe. Now, if I was like, a coach, I'd be like, come on, Brindamore. You're killing it for the rest of us.
I feel like Rick Tockett's in that same discussion.
He absolutely is.
He is absolutely jacked for a 61-year-old man.
All right, final few minutes of the show here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And just to dip back into the inbox for something that came up earlier, which was, of course, Elliot Friedman reporting that one of the, I don't know if hang up is too strong or sticking point, but at least something that's come up between Rick Tockett and the Canucks as they see if they're going to go forward as a partnership here is the lack of a practice facility. And Liam from Coquitlam texts in, can the Canucks and the new Vancouver PWHL team collaborate on a dedicated practice facility that can accommodate both teams? That's Liam, the F1 guy from Coquitlam. Peter in Cloverdale, of course, says a startup league has its practice facility sorted out before even coming up with a franchise name. Canucks org likes to drag its feet unless it's signing a mediocre free agent at an above market value. And of course, Peter's referencing the deal for the PWHL Vancouver team playing out of Pacific Coliseum, practicing out of the Agri Dome. And I do think it's understandable that a lot of people look at this and say, well, hold on a second. They've existed officially for what, a week?
Yep.
And they have a practice facility sorted out. Now, is it as simple as, well, the Canucks should just practice out of the Agri Dome? There could be a million reasons why that doesn't work for the Canucks. It's not necessarily that simple. But at a certain point, there's all these excuses we can come up with and real estate prices and this and partnerships and all that. The job is to find a way to do it. The job is to find the solution that works for you, even if it's not perfect, even if you have to bend in some ways or sacrifice some things that are important. The job is to get it done. And it is notable that the PWHL team is coming into the league with it ready. And we're at what? How many years now talking about it in Vancouver?
Yeah, the ultimate reality here, guys, that it's a competitive aspect of this game, right? We think of scoring goals and winning games. This is also the business side of it, where it's also very competitive.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're trying to lure the best customer, the best client, which would be the player in this case, you got to have that. And the PWHL versus NHL facility standards, I'm not sure if, you know, the Agri Dome is up to standard for what an NHL team would want. Right,
like, no, that's what I mean. It's not that simple. Like, just use that.
Yeah, well, the text inbox in reference to that, like, there's more to it, is what I'm saying. But it is a results-based industry, because if every other team, including the Calgary Flames, which they have a plan for, has that facility, you are at a disadvantage. And Vancouver is a beautiful place to live. It has amazing people want to come here. The team is so relevant. The team is number one in this market. But once you have all things equal, stuff like this matters. So a resolution at some point is going to be required, because in a competitive place like NHL free agency, like the business of no trade clauses, stuff like this does matter.
Yeah, you have to be able to put your best foot forward, whether it's retaining a head coach, attracting free agents, retaining your own star players. You need every edge you can possibly get. That's the show for today, Randeep. Thank you for filling in for the last few days. Much appreciated. I'm pretty sure Drance will be back on the show tomorrow. We'll see.
I'm on call, man.
I guess we'll find out when we go live at noon whether Drance is going to be back on the show tomorrow. But there will be Canucks talk on the air tomorrow. By the way, go vote. If you haven't already, go vote. And we will be back on the air tomorrow here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.